My friends and fellow Democrats, looking around this room tonight and seeing all the confidence and enthusiasm of you men and women gathered here from 41 states, I can only say that if all of this shows the Democratic Party in defeat, then I have no fear for the future of our country. We are not defeated because the ideas we have put into effect during the past 20 years and the direction we have set have become deeply ingrained in our national life. Now, at this point, may I give a bit of nonpartisan advice to the Republicans. I would remind them that if they stray too far from the Democratic platform, which they conveniently borrowed during the course of the campaign, they will find themselves out of office a bit sooner than they now expect. In our efforts to keeping them from making this mistake, and I suppose that's the responsibility of the opposition these days, but I'm not at all sure that we can succeed in this, no matter how hard we try. But in all of these efforts, we can count upon a spokesman who uses words to communicate ideas and not as a substitute for thought. He believes that freedom is more than a slogan. He knows that freedom must carry with it those social and economic decencies which alone can make it real to all Americans. And above all, that freedom of thought and of speech is the source of all freedom. That is his faith and ours. And because he's not afraid to affirm it, this man, almost unknown last July, is today a trusted and compelling figure in our national life. And I can testify that he has reached the minds and hearts of free peoples everywhere, and has come to be a symbol of a mature and responsible America. We are proud of this man for the leadership he gave us during the campaign. We are even prouder of him today, and I am confident that he will inspire us to victory in 1954, not just for our party, but for the forces of freedom everywhere. My friends, Adlai E. Stevenson.
Mr. Harriman, Mrs. Roosevelt, Miss Truman, distinguished guests and my very dear friends. Mr. Harriman is no longer Mutual Security Administrator, but I am delighted that he will now have some time to devote by political action to the mutual security of us Democrats. And because of his infinite experience to the security of all Americans. I am flattered indeed by the very kind words that Mrs. Roosevelt uttered about me here this evening. Mrs. Roosevelt may have been replaced by the new administration on the Commission on Human Rights, but she will live in the hearts of multitudes throughout the world as the 20th century embodiment of the rights of mankind. In the absence of President Truman, I'm sure you all share my delight in finding here this evening Miss Margaret Truman. I have always marveled at the ingenuity of certain members of the Fourth Estate in creating news. They even linked my name some time ago with Margaret Truman's romantically. But that was before we had met. And since she met me, nothing else has appeared. It is now, my friends, some 3 months, 9 days, 19 hours, and 47 minutes since we conceded the election of General Eisenhower. Watching the conduct of our party during that time, I can only say that I am prouder than ever to be a Democrat. And that's my best Valentine. In that interval, General Eisenhower has had the honors of victory and also the misery, while I have had the miseries of defeat and a vacation. But as the newspapers say, to the victor belongs the toil. It seems to me very appropriate that the party with a heart should be having this great dinner here in New York on St. Valentine's Day. I'm sure that we Democrats are in a mood to love everybody. And of course, we'd be delighted if a few million more people would love us. I have questioned my qualifications to be speaking here this evening. My most recent distinction, after all, is the dubious one of being the first Democratic candidate defeated since Al Smith 24 years ago. But I confess that I derive some personal satisfaction from being associated with Al Smith, even in misfortune. And while I make no prediction, I would remind you that the Democratic Party made a very rapid recovery after the disastrous election of 1928. You know, there was even talk then of dissolving the Democratic Party. What a difference today. There have been few, if any, recriminations. Little crying over spilt milk. Nearly all of the inevitable postmortems have been intelligent and constructive. I think of no instance where a party has so quickly and so spontaneously recovered its spirit. It's astonishing. It's exhilarating, and it's also contagious. I freely admit that the sportsmanship, the courtesy, and the charity shown to me by so many of you leaders of our party following the election have comforted and fortified me immensely. I am very grateful also for the deluge of messages that has engulfed me from people in and out of our party all over the country. I must confess that I began by nibbling at this mass of correspondence, but it made me feel so good that I gradually increased the dosage. Even if it's not quite as good as a few million votes, it certainly eased the pain. Now, the new administration has been in office, in power, for 25 days. This is not a very long time, as we Democrats count time in office. And therefore, my friends, I don't believe what I hear murmured around the country, that it's time for a change. This seems to me hasty and quite unjust. For the team, as they call it, has hardly begun to play. You know, indeed, it had a little trouble getting started. The star defense man looked ideal.
He weighed 4 or 5 million. And I mean he was good and heavy. But he got into an argument right away with the referee, and he was penalized for holding. Now, there's a real temptation for us Democrats to relax in our unaccustomed position on the sidelines, to sit back and enjoy it as Monday morning quarterbacks, while the Republicans have the novel experience of scrimmaging with reality. For 20 years, they developed blocking to a fine art, and now they must do something themselves about the awful problems of this revolutionary age. But we cannot succumb to this temptation. I hope we have learned from the Republican example how not to be an opposition party. This is an unfamiliar role for us, and one we have not filled with invariable distinction in the past. As the opposition party, we must be very careful how we interpret our title. We shall fight them to the end when we think they are wrong. But our central purpose, our guiding light, must be something different. It must be to keep on working as Senator Johnson and as Sam Rayburn and as your chairman and as Mrs. Roosevelt has said, to keep on working positively and constructively for the good of our country. Now, of course, it's easier to express these lofty sentiments than it is to practice them. Undoubtedly, we will have our partisan moments. But let us never be content merely to oppose. Let us always propose something better. Thanks to President Truman and his cabinet, gravely conscious of the perils of our times, the government has been transferred smoothly and with the heartiest goodwill. This is as it should be. We differ on many things, but we wear in common the seamless garment of the love of our country. The government is our government as well as theirs. May I say then that we wish President Eisenhower, his official family, and the Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, Godspeed in the awful trials that they face. Our prayers go with them. In the dark, the evil, haunted night, we all must traverse, confronting an enemy whose massive power is matched only by its malevolent purpose. The outcome of their efforts will profoundly affect all men everywhere, for good or evil. As they see or fail to see, understand, act, or fail to act. So may the warm sun continue to shine upon living men, or the cold moon rise upon an empty earth. We, the opposition, in these fateful days must contribute much more than epithets, than smears and witch hunts to the solutions of our problems. And I have been delighted to see that the Democrats in the Congress, led by such great Americans as Sam Rayburn in the House and Senator Lyndon Johnson in the Senate, have been following exactly this kind of positive and intelligent opposition. But the Congress will not be the only place where the Democrats write their record. Democrats hold many offices in the states and cities, and we are going to hold many more, I will add, a couple of years from now. But, my friends, there's only one sure way to do this, and that is by offering better candidates, better programs, better organization than our opponents. In the townships, the cities, the counties, the congressional districts, the states, as well as the nation, our job is to make the Democratic Party stand for sound and progressive policies, so that it will attract honest, forward-looking, and independent-thinking citizens. Last fall, there was a formidable upsurge of interest by the people of our country in politics. Men and women took part in the campaign who had never before participated in political activities, ringing doorbells, addressing envelopes, and doing all of the pick and shovel jobs on which success depends. Many did this in the regular parties. Many more were in the independent citizens groups. These people are the new blood of our political life. We need them. And to keep them, we must have programs and candidates that will command their active allegiance. The Republican Party is attempting what has not been tried for a long time: government by businessmen. America has always been a nation ripe for experiment. We Democrats have experimented boldly and accomplished miracles. Because the Republican experiment is new in these times and different, doesn't mean that it is bad. On the contrary, it deserves a thorough and a fair test. And it faces this test under far more favorable conditions than we Democrats had when we inherited a broken and a despairing nation 20 years ago. Today, the misery and despair are forgotten. 3 weeks ago, we were able to pass on to the Republicans a thriving, a healthy concern. Never has our land been more prosperous. Never have more men and women been working. Never have more goods flowed from our farms and factories to our people. And this is true even though during the campaign it sometimes sounded as if we were tottering on the brink of economic and moral disaster. Fortunate indeed is the administration which has been happy enough to inherit such a rich and abundant estate. We trust that it will guard it carefully, its magnificent inheritance, and not again permit the economic machine to rattle, cough, and collapse. And when I say this, I am thinking about beef and corn and cotton and milk, as well as the price of automobiles. Now, I, for one, am prepared to give this business administration my heartiest support, as long as it works faithfully for the public interest. But history warns us, I think, that government by a single group, no matter how high-minded and patriotic it may be, exposes government to genuine dangers. There is always a tendency to mistake the particular interest for the general interest. To suppose, in the immortal thought recently uttered before a committee of Congress, that what is good for General Motors is good for the country. There is always the possibility that the successor of the New Deal will turn out, after the fine words have faded away, to be the big deal. While the new dealers have all left Washington to make way for the car dealers, I hasten to say that I, for one, do not believe the story that the General Welfare has become a subsidiary of General Motors. Yet this most recent experiment in the management of our public affairs demands our support and our sympathy. It demands it, if for no other reason than the crisis we all face together in the world. And let us not deceive ourselves about the size of the conspiracy, the sullen, somber men, the morbid misanthropes of the Kremlin, hardened and disciplined by their monstrous philosophy, dispose of staggering resources in population, in land, in raw materials, and in the zeal, which is the product of fanatical faith as well as of ugly fear and ruthless ambition. The recent outburst of communist anti-Semitism is the climax of this career in cynicism and horror. At the present time, according to the best estimates, their production is growing at a rate approximately twice our own. And this
in a period of remarkable expansion of our own economy. And they are in the struggle to stay. We delude ourselves if we think that a few words uttered on the shortwave radio will cause this iron regime to shatter and disintegrate. That a few blasts on the trumpets of psychological warfare and the walls will come tumbling down. The last thing we want, I would suppose, is to stand alone against this threat, to get into a situation where our young men must bear by themselves the full brunt of the communist assault. This is why our policy has been one of collective strength and mutual security. Our allies share with us not only bases and raw materials and manpower, but more important, the common faith in the worth of free men, which is our most potent weapon. We need our allies as they need us. The fact that we have been in a position to contribute most to this collective defense in the way of arms and money does not entitle us to preach or threaten. And I hope I have... misunderstood some news of late that sounds to me better calculated to provoke distaste for us than respect. We want no sullen obedience, but friendly cooperation. We want understanding. We want understanding from them of our problems and our heavy tax burdens, even as we patiently try to understand their difficulties. We want no satellites. We want companions in arms. We want the simple companionship of free men embattled in common cause. For we of the NATO countries and the other free nations are banded together, once and for all, in sickness or health, till, or rather lest, atomic death us do part. I hope I have misread the signs of the revival of the discredited dollar diplomacy. I hope we are forging no silver chains. We have heard much about the psychological offensive, but we will frighten no Russians by threatening our allies. And on the contrary, the Kremlin is encouraged by every sign of division within our ranks. We Democrats have always favored greater European unity as the only permanent way to make Europe economically solvent and militarily independent. Since 1947, it has been a prime object of our policy. The very core of the Marshall Plan lay in its treatment of Europe as an entity, using private persuasion rather than public pressure. We have helped create the Organization for European Economic Cooperation, the European Payments Union, and now the Schuman Plan for pooling coal and steel. A European constitution is being fashioned, and a European defense community is a near reality. But we shouldn't be, therefore, too critical of Secretary Dulles. So far as I can see, what he has been trying to do in his way is to sell the Truman-Acheson foreign policy to Europeans. Now, these achievements are not accidental. They are the result of a purposeful policy and a friendly persuasion. A genuine partnership operates through consultation and persuasion. There is no room for it, in it for the big stick or the ultimatum, be it the small or the medium size or even the large economy size. Ours must be the role of the good neighbor, the good partner, the good friend, never the big bully. And we cannot, my friends, enlist the support of ordinary people abroad if we do not trust them at home. The Democratic and Republican parties today are separated by the same old principles which divided Jefferson and Hamilton when parties first began in the United States. Hamilton felt that only men of wealth and affairs were qualified to understand and conduct our government. Jefferson had faith in all the people. And in this faith, our party has fought for the poor and the humble and the weak when they were oppressed by the wealthy, the strong, and the unscrupulous. This has been the central concept of our party, given fiery expression by Andrew Jackson and renewed by the great democratic leaders of our own century, by Woodrow Wilson, by Franklin Roosevelt, and by that man of independence, our nation's leading private citizen, Harry Truman. And it is interesting to note, by the way, after all of the clatter and the criticism and the denunciation of the campaign, the two laws which President Eisenhower wants to amend, were both vetoed by President Truman. There has never been a time in history when it is more necessary to reaffirm our democratic faith in all of its vigor, yes, in all of its majesty, too. Some in America today would limit our freedom of expression and of conscience. In the name of unity, they would impose a narrow uniformity of idea and opinion. Let no one mistake where the Democratic Party stands on this. We glory in the multiplicity of strains and cultures and ideas that are woven into the tapestry we call America. And we share forever Jefferson's eternal hostility to any form of tyranny over the mind of man. Our farms and our factories may give us our living, but the Bill of Rights gives us our life. Whoever lays rough hands upon it lays rough hands upon you and me. Whoever profanes its spirit diminishes our inheritance and beclouds our title to greatness as a people. If we win men's hearts throughout the world, it will not be because we are a big country, but because we are a great country. Bigness is imposing, but greatness is enduring. Only a government which fights for civil liberties and equal rights for its own people can stand for freedom in the rest of the world. And only a people who can achieve the moral mastery of themselves can hope to win the moral leadership of others. Opposition confers opportunity. Adversity tests the soul and strengthens the will. Yield not, I say to you, thy neck to fortune's yoke, but let the dauntless mind still ride in triumph over all mischance. The Democratic Party understands the nature of the contemporary challenge, the party of all the people. It can speak to all the people everywhere. The party which champions the poor and humble, it can understand the strivings of the poor and humble everywhere. The party of freedom and opportunity. It can hold high the torch of democracy and light the way to liberty for men and women everywhere. And because the Democratic Party understands the challenge of history, history will reward it once again with responsibility. Thank you.